The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Florence Nash from Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the August-September issue of AARP Magazine. Maybe a little something else, but mainly from AARP Magazine. Our programming today is generously underwritten by Salibi Chiropractic. Salibi Chiropractic welcomes the geriatric community with any neck, back, or hip issues. Call 919-782-4733. That's 919-782-4733. Now, when we ran out of time last week, we were in the middle of their personal best section. We had read two or three very nice entries from people, and we've got a few more for you. The next one is called The Beauty of a Bee. And this is by Blaise, I guess Herka is the way you pronounce his name. He was a Benedictine monk at the Prince of Peace Abbey in Oceanside, California for more than 45 years and in Indiana for 15 years before that. He died shortly before the magazine deadline, unfortunately, at the age of 80. He says, "We join the monastery to give praise to God. That's our primary work in the church. Of course, I also have a lot of hobbies to keep me out of mischief. I have about 85 fruit trees I take care of. All kinds of fruit, pear, apple, fig, orange, avocado, everything. I needed bees to pollinate the trees, so I started going around collecting swarms. I have about 50 hives, and we sell the honey. On a typical day, we get up early for 5:30 prayers, then we have a little break, then we have another prayer service at 7 o'clock. Then it's time for breakfast. And then we all have a work period to do chores. My thing is plumbing, constant drippy faucets. It's just never ending. You know how a household is. You can't ever catch up. We have liturgy at 11 a.m., then lunch, then another work period. That's usually when I take care of the bees. The best time of the day for it is when the sun is up and hot. Bees teach us so many lessons. When they take all this nectar from the tree, does that deprive the tree of anything? No, it enhances it. And when you give your time and energy to helping someone, does it deplete your skills? No, it gives you something to be proud of. There are many, many parallels. Bees are so essential to our ecology. Without them, trees don't bear fruit, and they can just take this flower and transform it into honey. That's a miracle, really. Next, under personal best, we've got My Education, An Honest Legacy. Undergrad Melisande Short Colombe treads ground saved by her ancestors' sacrifice. Melisande Short Colombe is 64 years old and a member of Georgetown University's class of 2021. She says, "Before I decided to apply to college, I thought long and hard. I was already a fully actualized adult. I had a career as a chef and caterer. I had 4 grown children, but I was physically worn out by my work, and I was thinking, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? I'd lost my home on the Mississippi Gulf Coast during Hurricane Katrina, and since then I'd been sort of like the Flying Dutchman. I'd gone to Austin, Texas for 9 months, lived in West Africa for a year, moved back to Austin, then to New Orleans, then worked at a resort on the island of St. Croix. My grandmother had always told me that our ancestors had been important free people in Maryland. My first ancestor of record arrived in the colony in 1715 as a free woman, but she was put into indentured servitude to the Jesuits, the same order that later founded Georgetown University in what would become Washington. Although the terms of her indenture were met, she was kept enslaved, as were her children and grandchildren. Her grandsons sued for their freedom. Some of them were freed, but not all of them. And so, in 1838, members of my family were among the 272 people whom the Jesuits sold south to Louisiana to keep Georgetown afloat. A couple of years ago, the university decided to offer legacy status to any descendant of the people sold. That's the same status given to the children of alumni. It's not a guarantee of admission, but if you meet the standards otherwise, it's a leg up. When I heard about the offer, I thought, well, that's me. I did feel trepidation because of my age. I get along with the other students, but the professors and other adults here are my peers. I have learned as I've gotten older that growing as a human being is a lifelong process. Although I haven't decided on a major, I'm very interested in history. If we are unwilling to face the flaws of our past, how do we embrace a future that is inclusive? And finally, in the personal best entries, we have novelist Louis Bayard, who is 54 and writes historical novels, including the upcoming Courting Mr. Lincoln. He says, "A paper trail, how novelist Louis Bayard's lost friends live on. Why don't you throw it out?" my 14-year-old asks, "or digitize it or something." He's referring to my address book, which is quite a few years older than he is. A dowdy, floppy thing, it was originally bought at a museum bookstore. Its front cover is a faded reproduction of The Scream, and its back cover is very close to coming off. At 5 by 4 inches, it's small enough to be chewed up by the dog or tossed out with the newspaper or simply stuffed into the back of some drawer never to be seen again. It is, in short, a terrible way to store important data. If I had any sense, I would have long ago wafted these names and coordinates up to the virtual cloud. Yet the book lingers, and my affection for it mysteriously grows. With each passing year, in fact, I find that what matters more to me than any address is the book itself. If you opened it at random, you'd find mostly chaos. Out of every 10 addresses, 9 have been edited. Sometimes there's a zip code without a city, sometimes the reverse. Here and there, in a burst of archival fervor, I've inked in the names of children whose parents I've long since lost touch with. A few of my addresses I haven't laid eyes on in more than 20 years. One I've never met, my late father's first wife, who may still be living on the Via San Leonardo in Florence. And some have their own peculiar narrative. The women friends who, upon marriage, traded in their last names and then, a few years later, reclaimed them. The couples who separated and then, after a pause, reunited. The straggling arc of my aging parents, first in Northern Virginia from the 4-bedroom suburban home in Dunloring to the ranch house in Arlington to the 2-bedroom apartment in Falls Church. Next, a brief caesura, after which my mother reemerges as a solitary figure, soldiering from a Sunrise facility in Boston to addresses in Alameda, California, and ultimately, it would seem, Chicago. In this sea of strike-throughs, the only thing that halts my pen is death. If you were to judge by my address book, my dear friend Bob is still alive and well in Atlanta. Pat, the funniest man I've ever met, is still camped in his Northern Virginia apartment. My beloved editor Marjorie is still gardening in upstate New York. None of this is exactly a lie, because everyone who was ever added to these heavily thumbed pages is still with me, on paper that is as perishable as we are. I'm not throwing it out. I'm sure as hell not digitizing it. I'm only hoping to pass it on. Now, in there. Health section, AARP offers us a health report called What to Eat When You're 70+. Official nutrition guidelines may be steering you wrong. Chew on these tips to adjust your diet for maximum health. This is by Clint Harder. Back in 1980, the U.S. government released a 20-page pamphlet called Dietary Guidelines for Americans. Among its 7 simple suggestions, eat a variety of foods, avoid too much sugar, and so on. Since then, the U.S. has revised the dietary guidelines every 5 years, and each new edition has grown longer and more complex. The latest version, released in 2015, packs 122 pages of nutrition rules for men and women at every life stage. Well, almost. The guidelines cover children, teens, and adults up to age 50, but they lump the entire 50 50-plus population into one group, instructing older adults to eat the same types and amount of food, whether they're 51, 71, or 101. And therein lies the danger. Hospitals and senior centers adjust their menus to abide by the guidelines, so older Americans who are more likely to get their meals from group homes or hospitals are affected by the guidelines as much as, or more than, any other segment of the population. Obviously, a 55-year-old has very different nutritional needs from someone who's 70, says professor and nutrition researcher Catherine Tucker, a member of the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, the organization that develops the RDAs. To understand just how different, let's look at protein. Although the RDA is the same for 19 and 90-year-olds, aging bodies lose muscle faster and digest protein less efficiently. To maintain both their muscle mass and their health, older adults need more protein in their daily diet. In one study of subjects with a mean age of 70, those who maintained their muscle mass lived an average of 6 years longer than those who had lost a significant amount. I'm very comfortable saying that the RDA for protein is probably too low for older people, Tucker adds. That's not the only dietary need that diverges from the official recommendations. We scoured the nutritional data and talked with experts to find out how to adjust your eating for the years ahead. 1. Eat more lean meat, fish, and dairy. Eat less sugary carbohydrates. Starting at 40, we lose 1% of our muscle mass each year. This is where protein helps. The government advises consuming a minimum of 46 grams a day if you're a woman and 56 grams if you're a man. But in one 10-week study, men in their 70s were given either the U.S. Department of Agriculture recommended amount of protein or twice that quantity. At the study's end, those eating the official recommendation had lost muscle, while those taking in double the amount added muscle around their core and increased their leg strength. If eating upward of 100 grams of protein a day seems like a lot, it's not. To hit those numbers, cut down on the bagels and cookies and build your diet around the foods used in the study. Lean meat, fish, eggs, milk, yogurt, nuts, and seeds. Number 2. Eat more protein at breakfast. Eat less food at dinner time. Eating more protein is just half the battle. You have to space it out over the course of a day. Although a giant sirloin steak at dinner may deliver 90 grams of protein, your body can process only about 30 grams of protein at a time. Your body stores the rest as fat, and the protein's essential amino acids get peed out. So shoot for 20 to 30 grams at each of the day's three major meals. That's as simple as a couple of scrambled eggs at breakfast and a turkey sandwich at lunch. Aim for at least one small serving from animal sources. A lot of the plant-based proteins lack one or more amino acids, says Douglas Patton Jones, a professor of health and aging at the University of Texas Medical Branch. So, generally, animal-based proteins are deemed higher quality. 3. Eat more brightly colored veggies. Eat less beige food. A shrinking appetite is one of the dangers of aging. Older people will have toast and tea for breakfast and say, "I'm not hungry," notes nutritionist Johnny Bowden, author of The Most Effective Ways to Live Longer. Nutrition matters, even if your appetite's declining. To feed your body what it needs when you're not as hungry, focus on nutrient density. In addition to protein, aim to eat brightly colored vegetables. Vivid colors are a sign of higher level of nutrients for the same number of calories. Go for sweet potatoes instead of white potatoes, spinach instead of yellow squash, romaine instead of iceberg lettuce. In a study, women 70 and older who ate more than 3 daily servings of vegetables had 5% less plaque in their arteries than did women who ate fewer than 2. Number 4. Drink more whey and plant protein smoothies. Drink less fruit juice. If you're struggling to hit your 20 to 30 grams of protein, drink milk or a scoop of powdered whey protein in water with your meal. Fast digesting liquid proteins can help counter a slowing digestive system. Fruit juice, on the other hand, is a calorie-dense beverage loaded with sugar. 5. Eat more oily fish, olive oil, and avocados. Eat less saturated fat. Look for brain-healthy omega-3 and monounsaturated fats. Limit saturated fats, such as butter or animal fat. A study found that older women who took in under 20 grams a day of saturated fats were about 10% less likely to die from heart disease than those who consumed over 30. 6. Eat more bran cereal. Eat less refined grains. In one study published this year, a researcher from Brigham Young University calculated that an extra 10 grams of fiber per 1,000 calories can lead to an extra 4.8 years of life. It's hard to hit those numbers unless you start the day with bran cereal. And this article ends with a dining tip. Your essential food group. Eating with other people makes good nutrition easier. Government guidelines tell us what to eat, but don't tell us how to eat. Recent studies have shown that regularly eating alone can increase your risk of obesity, malnutrition, depression, and even early death. Poor nutrition is at least partly to blame, says geriatrician Christine Ritchie, a professor of medicine at the University of San Francisco. When you eat alone, you're less likely to want to make much of a meal. You're less likely to linger around the food and enjoy it for the purposes of the social connection. The solution is to join community groups and set standing breakfast or lunch dates with friends and family. Now, as long as we're on the subject of food, here is an article in the same issue called Great Food Worth a Detour. The United States today is a foodie's paradise, rich with succulent regional dishes, a blend of ethnic flavors, and plenty of good old American creativity and boldness. Next time you're on the road, consider taking a side trip to taste any of these extraordinary dishes. This is by Christina Yanzito. Signature dishes. Cincinnati chili from Ohio. The long-ago inspiration of Macedonian immigrants. This chili is made of spiced meat sauce plopped on spaghetti, then topped with a whole lot of grated cheddar, kidney beans, and or chopped onion. That whole stomach-stretching shebang is called a five-way, and no twirling. It's eaten with a knife and fork. From Louisiana, we've got gumbo. Like the city of New Orleans itself, gumbo is an eclectic mix prepared by home cooks and restaurant chefs in infinite variations that may or may not include okra, chicken, sausage, or seafood. The Creole stew has a rich, smoky flavor that comes from a dark French roux and sometimes filet, ground sassafras leaves. Louisianans are so passionate about the dish, it inspires countless arguments and controversies, says Nora McGunigal, a New Orleans food blogger. Everyone thinks, no, knows that their or their family's gumbo is the best. From Michigan, we have pasty. It rhymes with nasty, not tasty. But this portable delight is best described by the latter. A yummy, simple mix of ground beef or pork, rutabagas, and potatoes, it's baked in a pocket of dough. Based on the version born in Cornwall, England, as an easy-to-hold meal for miners, the pasty arrived with those who came to work the copper mines in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. It's now often enhanced with condiments. There's always a big debate over whether you pour ketchup or gravy on the pasty, says Charlie Hopper, general manager of the UP's Pasty Central, which ships about 45,000 pasties around the U.S. every year, many to homesick transplanted Michiganders. From Missouri, we have toasted ravioli. T-Rav, as the locals call it, stems from a happy accident. A local cook missed the hot water and dropped some ravioli into hot oil, sprinkled some Parmesan cheese on top, and presto, a crispy classic was born. Now it can be found all over St. Louis, but particularly on The Hill, the city's Italian neighborhood, at eateries such as Mama's. The key is the tangy tomato sauce for dipping. That's what gives T-Rab that grandma made this just for me feeling, says area food blogger Josie Bell. From South Carolina, we've got Frogmore Stew. It's not a stew and has no frogs. Named for a tiny island town close to the Georgia border, this one-pot southern feast, often known as a low country boil, is typically a heap of boiled shrimp, sausage, potatoes, corn, and seasonings all cooked together, pretty much perfect for enjoying with a cold drink on a summer night. Then from Kentucky, we've got Burgoo. Think gumbo and jazz, because burgoo is an improvisational thick mix of meats, pork, beef, whatever is on hand, simmered for hours in iron kettles with cornmeal or oats and veggies. Sometimes you get a super spicy rendition cooked with chili peppers or a splash of bourbon. Where its name came from is as debatable as its recipe, but Kentuckians have been making the stew since around the Civil War. It has long been a staple at potlucks, picnics, and Kentucky Derby parties, often generously accompanied by that other state signature, bourbon. And in the seafood category, we've got, from Maryland, blue crabs. Marylanders are nuts about crabs. Enjoy them as crab cakes or in their soft shell form, a delicacy that's often battered, fried, and eaten whole. But it's hard to beat gathering at a picnic table to pick the scrumptious, salty, sweet meat from a bushel of steamed hard shell crabs, flavored with a liberal dose of Old Bay seasoning, a wonderful, messy rite of summer. From Massachusetts, we get New England clam chowder. Sure, you can find this richly flavored cream-based soup of clams, clam juice, onions, salt pork or bacon, and potatoes beyond the Northeast, sometimes listed as Boston clam chowder. You won't get a better bowl, though, than when it's made with fresh, sweet local bivalves in a state with such a strong chowder, or as they say in these parts, chowder, tradition. One top spot for the soup is Boston's oldest restaurant, the Union Oyster House, established in 1826, where it served chunky with oyster crackers. Note, if your chowder has tomatoes, you're probably not in New England. That's a New York thing. From Maine, it's lobster rolls. Imagine fresh chilled lobster on a toasted or warm hot dog bun, seasoned with salt and pepper, a bit of mayo, and a drizzle of butter. Savor it at a seafood shack on the rocky Maine coast, and you have an unforgettable, authentic food experience, says Travel Channel culinary expert Andrew Zimmern. His go-to spot for lobster rolls is Five Islands Lobster Company near Portland, where you can literally watch the lobsters come from the traps to the boat to the dock, from the water to the pot to your plate. And then in Washington, we have gooey duck. Well, it looks like geoduck, but even its pronunciation sounds suspect, gooey duck. But as freakish as this huge, often 2+ pounds, clam may look, with its fleshy neck protruding grotesquely from its shell, it's a beloved state food that's in high demand here and in Asia, which is why its price has soared to $40 and up per pound. Its slightly crunchy meat is prepared different ways, though typically raw, sometimes sliced thin or chopped fine for sashimi, sushi, or crudo. Find it on the menu at many Seattle restaurants, such as Taylor Shellfish Farm's Oyster Bar at Pioneer Square. And from California, we get Chopino, a hearty stew of mixed seafood and tomato sauce spiked with garlic and herbs. Chopino was introduced to San Francisco by immigrant Italian fishermen from Genoa in the mid to late 1800s. Its name may come from chupin, the Genoese word for little soup. The first eatery known to have served chupino is Aliotto's, still in business on the city's touristy fisherman's wharf. Now under ethnic entries, we've got from New Mexico, carne adobada. The simple but succulent recipe is all about the heat. pork marinates in a red chili sauce for hours with garlic and spices. It ends up tender and tangy. Fantastic shredded in tacos or on its own. From California, Korean Tacos. Introduced to Los Angeles in 2008, courtesy of a food truck called Koji, these tacos are now a fixture in Southern California. Corn tortillas are piled with Korean-style barbecued short rib meat, chili soy slaw, and cilantro onion lime relish, offering an addictive sweet spicy salty flavor combo. From Nebraska, it's Runza. You can't have too many variations on the brilliant meat-in-a-bread pocket concept, can you? This version, brought here by German and Russian immigrants and also called Birox, has sautéed beef, cabbage, onions, and spices baked in dough. The juicy, hot, and hearty sandwich is available across the state, but its trademarked name belongs to, yes, the 82-restaurant chain Runza. From West Virginia, it's pepperoni rolls. It's a yummy treat deeply rooted in the state's food culture. Slightly sweet bread dough is wrapped around pepperoni and baked. All those spices and oils seep into the dough while it bakes, says Candice Nelson, author of the West Virginia Pepperoni Roll. So you're getting the magic that happens when they combine. And then among a few stranger things, we have from Hawaii, Spam Musubi. Want to eat like a true Hawaiian? Try this sweet and savory and, no joke, delectable staple. A block of pressed rice with a slice of spam fried in a special soy sauce sugar glaze, all wrapped in dried seaweed. Eaten as a snack or a light meal, Spam Musubi is sold at nearly every market in the state. From Colorado, we've got Rocky Mountain oysters. The word gross springs to mind. These are bull or bison testicles rolled in flour and fried, but they're a dish some Coloradans relish, with all the requisite jokes. From North Carolina, it's liver mush, a loaf of hog meats held together with spices and cornmeal. It's offered at diners fried with eggs or eaten with biscuits and sometimes a dab of grape jelly. All these dishes came to us with reporting by Ken Budd and Christopher Hall. And we'll end today with a couple of food tips from some foodies. One is Andrew Zimmern, whom we just mentioned. He says, let your taste buds lead the way. His travel philosophy is travel mouth first. If you're going to China, you shouldn't be eating at the Hard Rock Cafe in Shanghai. Explore what's unique to that city. The importance of place. Some dishes are replicated well all over, but it's never quite the same as having them where they originated. Tex-Mex food served in Wisconsin is not something that interests me. Drive a day for it? Without a doubt. I drive from Minnesota, where I live, just to have a cheesesteak at John's Roast Pork in Philadelphia. And now, it looks like we're just about at the end of our time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. I hope you'll listen next time and that you've enjoyed today. I'm Florence Nash, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and our programming today was generously underwritten by Salibi Chiropractic. Salibi Chiropractic welcomes the geriatric community with any neck, back, or hip issues. Call 919-782-4733. That's 919-782-4733. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. So long till next time.